Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by my firm, Herity & Herity, the go-to firm for the PAN 300 for PAN preparation and prosecution. I'm Eli Mazur, and today we're lucky to be joined by Mark Hahn, the President Chief Legal Officer of IntuitiveX. IntuitiveX has created a new model for using the PAN process to help innovators start companies and bring their products to market. Mark, I was thinking, and this is a theme that often comes up on my podcast, is that for a group of people, PAN attorneys who deal with innovation every day, there's really not that much innovation that goes on in our field. Most PAN attorneys are happy to kind of do what they learn at their first job. So thank you so much for joining. I'm excited to kind of learn about all of the innovation in the field that you've been involved in, not just innovation in technology. So before we begin, I guess the first question that I always start with is, do you remember when you first learned about patents?
First learning about patents was in, I'd say, undergrad. So my background's in electrical engineering. I went to the University of Minnesota, and the initial plan, of course, was to obtain, you know, my EE degree and pursue a career in possibly, you know, the field of computers and hardware or software or so forth. But then I did learn about patents from a family friend who was a patent attorney. And learning more about what it takes, what patent attorneys do on a day-to-day basis, sort of inspired me to abandon that initial plan of becoming an engineer and attending 3 years of law school and then becoming a patent attorney.
Did you have a dream career in mind when you finished law school?
You know, it didn't really apply because I had that engineering background, so I knew I would have to go into intellectual property. But growing up in the 80s, though, an amazing TV show was LA Law. I don't know if you've heard of it. They did not deal with patents, I'll tell you that much. But it was such an attractive show, and I think that show single-handedly increased law school applications by a significant margin. I'm not even joking. Like, it's got to be at least 25%. But yeah, that show started off with, like, it started with a Mercedes-Benz, like the hood closing, and then it later, like, went on to a Bentley or something. It's just that Hollywood vision of being a rich attorney inspired a lot of people to sort of consider it as an option. But for me, again, engineering background, going, you know, into patent law, I didn't have those types of dreams, but there was some attraction to law firm lifestyle versus, you know, being a junior engineer at a company.
And you worked at a bunch of law firms, and then you ended up at Intellectual Ventures, which I think you joined them around 2010, and that's really when they were in the news all the time. I think at one point they were called the largest and most notorious patent troll. But obviously, it was started by the CTO of Microsoft, who was a very impressive guy, and he had a different view of things. Do you remember when you first heard about them? What was your impression before you joined them of what Intellectual Ventures was about?
Sure. Well, when I first learned of IV, it was sort of this mysterious entity, right? Because even their website was very intentionally opaque. Like, you couldn't learn much from them. In fact, I believe the first staff employees that were hired way back in the day, I think they started around 2000 or shortly thereafter, they were hired on the premise that they weren't told what the company was doing until after they were hired and all the paperwork was signed. So I just learned of them as an entity where, okay, they do need IP experts. It appeared they were amassing, you know, some kind of IP portfolio and hopefully monetizing it or doing something great with it. And so, of course, I've heard of Nathan Myhrvold and Edward Jung. They were both top executives at Microsoft, and then they left to form IV. And so, you know, it was a mysterious yet attractive entity, especially for IP attorneys. And I was still working for IP boutique law firms at the time. But when an opportunity opened up for me to join IV, I jumped at the chance to at least interview. So just to learn more about it. And I ended up working there for 4 years.
So you mentioned they were intentionally opaque.
I think at the very beginning, and you know, even to this day, there aren't too many companies, at least of IV's size, that did what they did, right? I think their business model may have shifted since then, but when I was there from 2010 to 2014, it really was the heyday. It was the golden years of IV. Annual revenue, well into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And so it was a really polished machine, and the marketplace for IP was different than it is now as well. So in the news, you would hear of multi-billion dollar IP deals between large companies and so forth. And just trying to monetize patents was a big deal. It was really popular back then. And before 2010 and before, you know, Ivy attained that type of status, I think they had the foresight to build that IP portfolio, be the largest player in the space, and essentially be successful that way. And so while they were amassing their portfolio, I don't think they wanted to sort of, you know, tip their hand to anyone to try to mimic what they were doing. And so if you were a top exec there and being hired, you knew sort of what you were getting into. But I'm talking about the more general staff members. I can imagine them not knowing every detail of what the company was actually even doing when they got hired. Yeah.
They had different kind of stories that they were telling publicly. From what I understand, they had, at least what I would read in the, for example, in the New York Times, is that they would gather a bunch of smart people around who would come up with these innovations in the future, and then they would kind of seek patent protection for them. They were also obviously acquiring patents. I don't think that was even a secret. I guess you can't hide that too much. And third was that, I think you mentioned it to me and I haven't heard of that before, is that they were actually looking at these big societal problems. Can you tell us about that third prong?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you sort of alluded to, and this is public, is there were at the time three main funds at IV. So the Invention Investment Fund, which was the fund that I was a part of, was by far their largest fund. As you said, they were in the business of acquiring and developing IP assets as an investment. And so, and you can monetize it, obviously, for profit. There was a much smaller fund called Invention Development Fund, IDF. That's where they partnered with an international network of inventors and institutions like universities and so forth to tackle problems together and develop IP in the process. And then there was another smaller fund called Invention Science Fund. And so that's that last part that you mentioned where ISF had its own lab. Ivy was famous for a very sophisticated lab. It's actually part of the orientation process when you get hired. You visit the lab, you get to see all the cool stuff that Ivy's working on. And part of that was global good. And so it wasn't necessarily to make a ton of money because, you know, a lot of times these types of problems aren't solved by, you know, the most corporate or profit-making entities. And so whether it's controlling malaria in Africa through mosquito control, Ivy has a very famous laser technology that literally zaps mosquitoes out of the air based on wing beat frequency. And if you can target the mosquitoes that commonly carry malaria, then it's potentially a very effective way of controlling that disease, right? Other issues that they tackled were nuclear energy, lots of new technology there, as well as how to transport things like milk and keep it fresh. Again, in Africa, where the temperatures are not only hot, but you're not going to have any refrigeration for extended periods of time, right? Potentially weeks or even a month. And so how would you do that where you can make that portable and transport things like milk and keep it fresh, or medicine, you know, keeping medicine sufficiently cold to bring it to areas where people need treatment. And so again, like these types of problems, they can be in the news. And so IV gets pretty good publicity that way as well. But from my point of view, I can't imagine Ivy making a ton of money off of that, but it's a great way to utilize your resources and your technology to really improve life for people who don't have access to such things otherwise, right?
Yeah. Going back, what I'm curious about is, can you give us some sense about what was their thinking about how do we identify and acquire valuable portfolios?
Yeah. So when you're in the business of treating patents and patent portfolios as business assets, I mean, you're looking at which technologies are the most valuable. And so you vet a lot of IP based on different technology verticals. And so if you have the expertise to understand the market, so we'll just pick telecom, for example, as a certain vertical. Well, if you know that, one, it's certain entities need additional IP protection in that vertical, then IV was one such company that could provide it. And if you wanted to license it, then you get access to all of that IP and use it whether for various business purposes, offensive and defensive, right? And so if a certain company was potentially going to get sued because they were infringing and didn't have that valuable IP asset, well, IV was one entity that may have it. And if you license it from IV, then you have that in your portfolio to use defensively.
One of the underlying issues is there actually a market of products that actually rely on this IP or patents? But what about the patents themselves? What are the qualities? 30,000 patents, that's a lot of patents. You can't claim chart every claim, I imagine.
Right. IV did have an amazing collection of IP. And just numbers-wise, it was pretty staggering. And so even any company, whether it's IBM or otherwise, where you have, for example, tens of thousands of patents, they're not all going to be winners, right? Maybe you think they will be when you first start inventing and prosecuting these patent applications, but by the time they issue, the market may change and so forth. And especially with IV, if you're out targeting certain technologies and a big chunk of your business is buying, you know, IP assets, then you have to do your best to vet the IP to make sure that you're buying something valuable. There's a balance. Obviously, if every single patent is a home run, then they're going to command a huge purchase price, right? And so you can't afford to just buy all the best patents in the world. And what's common knowledge is even if you identify one patent that you just sort of have to have, let's say, you know, Eli, you're like, I'm an expert in field X, and that particular patent is the go-to patent for this field, and I need it. Well, usually that patent isn't alone, right? It's a member of a family. And so you want to just purchase that whole family because you don't want the sibling patents, continuations or the parents or whatever, to be owned by someone else, right? Like you want the rights to the whole family of patents that are related to each other. So you don't have to identify necessarily which patent in that family is the most valuable either. You can just approach a patent owner and say, hey, this particular family is very interesting and we would like to acquire it. Even within a given family, every patent isn't necessarily a winner.
Correct me if I'm wrong. My sense is that once intellectual ventures or similar situated NP identifies a valuable market, they look for portfolios that might cover it. And obviously, you know, I'm sure people approached brokers or companies directly approached IV to try to sell them portfolios. I guess your job was trying to manage that. And as somebody, you know, I'm sure in your law firm experience and in experience in-house in intellectual ventures. I mean, at that point, so it's kind of like you're taking over these families that are half alive and in various stages and what else. How does that work in terms of figuring out, well, what do you need to do with these portfolios now in terms of the prosecution strategy?
Sure. No, that's a great question. And so, you know, any given patent attorney can't pretend to be an expert in every technology area, right? And so if you're a company of IV size, then you'll have a team of IP attorneys who have background in certain areas. And so, of course, you're going to leverage that expertise. But sort of just to answer your question more broadly, I mean, the people who sell or assign or license their IP to IV are all shapes and sizes, right? So sometimes you do have the individual inventor in a garage who has a brilliant idea, but has no idea how to apply it to something or bring it to market, or maybe they even ran out of money. And so like it's still a pending application, but they don't have the money or the resources to push it all the way to issuance as a patent. And then you have other entities where, you know, they're an operating company, but IV wants to take over that technology. And so either way, there's going to be a transaction. So whether it's a purchase or some kind of assignment or a licensing deal that incorporates, I don't know, some kind of back-end royalty, who knows? But there's going to be that transaction where IV takes it over, and then that's where me and my team, when I was there, we then, you know, fully vet that portfolio. We determine, hey, how much to invest further into developing out. There's going to be some assets that aren't worth continuing to prosecute, and so we may just let it die. Who knows, right? But the assets that are deemed valuable, we will work with our engineering team.
Is there anything you think that surprised IV? They obviously had this model in mind. We're going to acquire them, identify the valuable assets, try to grow them, and then try to license them. Is there anything that they kind of learned that as a company?
Right. You know, you can do your best to sort of read a given market and monetize it under a certain set of rules, but then when those rules change, whether it's court rulings that change requirements or coverage of pants, then when the fundamental rules of the game change, that is a huge surprise, and your business model better be able to adapt, right? Also, I think IV had the business model of avoiding litigation at all costs, right? Because litigation is very risky and it's not the most predictable business model, right? And so if you can take that unpredictability out, then that's easier to sort of forecast your business performance. But when, one, the rules of the game changed and it was easier to challenge patents, and so at least initially, it almost had a devaluing effect, right? Because instead of complying with the patent owner and trying to figure out, hey, what's the best way to resolve this, or should we take a license and so forth, whatever, the default position became, okay, fine, you got me, but I'm just going to challenge your patent now. I'm going to try to invalidate your patent. And that changed the rules. It's a lot of entities tried to become what was called an efficient infringer, where even if you know you're infringing, you infringe anyways. You just go. And then if you get caught, you're like, well, I don't think your patent was valid, so I'm going to challenge it. Yeah, so that changed. And also, I think in some instances, the companies and entities that IV approached for trying to extract a license or some kind of cooperation, those entities all of a sudden became a little bit more willing to litigate, especially if they're a larger entity, right? And so if IV is being ambitious and like, hey, we want to chase after just massive international licensing deals, for example, then those large entities who can afford such deals can also afford litigation. So not only did, yeah, legislation change, but maybe the attitude of these companies also changed. So I think both of those were a large surprise to IV, but IV did its best to adapt.
At the beginning, you know, it was this huge behemoth that's going to take over the world, if not just the patent world. And then you kind of hear less and less about it. And then whatever the reporting you hear is, I guess, the funds haven't performed as well as they did. Do you think it was just really bad timing that when they kind of ramped up, that was like the height of the patent troll narrative? Actually, it's interesting that you mentioned about the laws changing, because back in 2010, I think Nathan Myhrvold, he defended the lobbying efforts because I guess he knew it was a big threat. So was it no matter when they would have tried to do what they tried to do, the pushback would have been?
Yeah, and the reputation of IV being the world's largest patent troll, it was widespread, but I don't think it was warranted. And the funny thing is, you know, Peter Detkin was one of the co-founders of IV. He was, I think, their top IP attorney at Intel, and he coined the term patent troll, and he became a co-founder of IV. But to the patent troll, you know, generally refers to patent owner who, despite owning junk, like, you know your patent sucks, but you're going to go assert it against somebody anyways, because let's say I have a crap patent and I bring it to you, Eli, and I say, like, I'm going to sue you or demand a royalty or licensing, you know, arrangement with you, or else we're going to go to court. And if I sue you for that, then it's going to cost you money to defend it, even if there's no merit, really. And so what patent trolls like to do is, hey, they just want to extract a nuisance fee, right? And so if you just pay me, I don't know, I'm just making up a number, $50,000, then I'll go away. And that's a much cheaper solution than if you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to successfully defend a lawsuit. Maybe if you're in a court or a jurisdiction that awards attorney's fees and so forth, then maybe in that case, it'll be cheaper, but it takes a lot of time and energy, right? Anyways, and so there are a lot of people who just say, fine, I know your patent is junk, but here's 50K, go away. And that's what patent trolls like to do. IV never really did that. Even though it was called the world's largest patent troll, it really did have valuable assets that had merit. And they only approached potential licensees or partners and so forth that were in a particular field and may have interest in that technology, right? It was never to try to extract a nuisance fee or hey, has to go away type of a thing. It was very much, hey, IV's employing hundreds of individuals who are experts in a technology or in the law, and we're trying to package them the best to people who may want to use it the most, right? And so I sort of understand why the rest of the world would say, oh, IV is the world's largest patent troll, but it's not an entirely fair term. And that's where Intuitive X comes into the picture. So my current company, we definitely do not want to do what IV did, or maybe to a lesser extent what they're doing. So what Intuitive X does differently is we actually want to either invent or help inventors bring their product to market. And we specialize more in the medical and life science space, but we help clients actually protect their ideas, develop prototypes, test and validate it, help them raise money, help them set up manufacturing capabilities, regulatory expertise to get FDA approval, and then ultimately bring their product to market and be successful, whether it's marketing and distribution and so forth. And down the road, either they become a very successful ongoing company or they have a successful exit, right? And that's the difference, yeah.
And actually, I want to dig more into that. So kind of a background for Intuitive X. The founder was a surgeon.
Yeah, right? Dr. Jeffrey Rowe, right.
He had some idea. He wanted to bring it to market and he kind of went through this process, and this is how Intuitive X was born. How did you become involved with it?
Yeah, no, so you're right. This idea of Intuitive X was born through Dr. Rowe's firsthand experience, and you're correct. He's a very accomplished orthopedic surgeon specializing in the minimally invasive space. And during his residency and when, you know, early on in his career, he invented new techniques for orthopedic surgery, whether it's a laser-guided approach or what have you. And he went through some struggles to not only get his ideas patented, but also acquired and adapted by the large players in the orthopedic space, right? So when a doctor goes up to a company, I say Medtronic or Stryker or J&J or, you know, a company like that, they won't necessarily give you the time of day, right? It's, you know, they have their own team and, you know, army of attorneys and otherwise. But he eventually, through just determination and sheer will, was able to get a large orthopedics company to not only acquire his IP, but bring him on as part of the design team to develop some of their most successful products in that space. And so Jeff knew, like, listen, for every person like me who is able to succeed, there's countless others who aren't, right? They just fall flat because they encounter the same resistance and sort of give up. And so he was sort of on a mission to make those other inventors and sometimes surgeons be successful as well, where as practicing doctors, like, they know what works and what doesn't and what new tools and inventions could be very successful, right, on a day-to-day basis. And so they come up with new inventions and sometimes they protect them, and then that's about as far as they go. They don't really form a new company, get them incorporated and develop the product and raise the money and so forth. So he had this vision of a company that would provide that service and really partner and in many cases incubate individuals and small companies to bring those ideas to fruition. And that's where myself and our other co-founder, Simon Robinson, came in. Beyond just the clinical expertise, you need the legal and the IP transaction expertise, because in the medical field, we like to say that it always starts with IP, because unlike the high-tech field, which is actually more, you know, my background anyways, if you're developing a new software app or, you know, a new gadget and so forth, sometimes you don't necessarily need to protect the idea. It may be more advantageous just to be first to market, right? So, like, let's say you're some young inventor living in your parents' basement and you have this idea for a new software app and you want to hurry up and try to get it on the iTunes platform. You can crunch that out, and if, you know, users adapt your app first, that may be the key to success. But in the medical space, if you're bringing a new surgical implant or whatever it is to market, it better be protected. Pharmaceuticals, the same thing. Because if it's not, then a larger player will certainly copy it and muscle you out because they have so much more resources than you do. And so 99.9% of the time, the first step is always protect that idea. And so Jeff knew that he needed some IP expertise to match his clinical expertise and just sort of build a one-stop shop that'll provide an end-to-end solution to people in the life science space who want to truly bring a new product to market and improve the health of its users.
So did you help Jeff before he founded Intuitive X?
Well, we were actually friends. And so we knew each other, but we never truly worked together until he wanted to build a company like this. And so we all, came together to form Intuitive X.
I think what you guys do is very interesting. So I want to go through examples. But before that, I guess the question that I had, you talked about the concept of efficient infringement in the high tech space. And you hear about stories where some small startup tries to work with one of these big tech companies. The big tech companies likes what it sees and says, we could actually just come up with that in air quotes. And if they try to sue us for patent infringement, we'll deal with that nuisance when it comes. I mean, is there something different? You were talking about these big companies in the medical space. Is there something different about how they operate? Or is just the IP just stronger? I guess the patents are just stronger in the healthcare space. It makes it more difficult for them to do that.
You're right. And so that's a great question where whether it's high tech or in a different area, there's always that concept of a bully not being afraid of muscling out a smaller player, right? And so whether the idea of efficient infringement is prevalent in the medical space, it's definitely less. And it may be because the nature of the market in the life science space, but I mean, if you take pharmaceuticals, for example, like a patent will literally protect a molecule or variations of a given molecule, right? And so there's really no way around it.
Yeah.
So unless you can prove that that molecule doesn't deserve protection, that patent covers that molecule or a variation of that molecule. So it's harder to work around a lot of the life science patents. I'm not saying all of them because there's so much overlap these days. There's digital health, right? And more we're incorporating high-tech technology into the medical field. But I think a lot of times, like, for example, what I just said regarding pharmaceutical patents or regarding medical device patents, like implants, by nature, they're very mechanical by definition. And so in many cases, it's harder to invalidate them because if it does what it says it does and no one else does it, it'll be pretty tough to invalidate it. And so I think there's just maybe more respect for a lot of these medical patents and like a greater willingness to cooperate on these types of transactions.
Is there something that you're looking for in an inventor that you want to work with? Does he have to be a doctor? Does he have to be a surgeon? Or, it could be just somebody who comes up with an app to diagnose a medical condition who's a layman.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And to answer it, basically, Intuitive X, we haven't really paid for marketing services and so forth. It was really just leveraging our own network and word of mouth. And so that network just happens to include a lot of doctors and surgeons, especially because of Dr. Rowe. He's director of minimally invasive surgery at Swedish. I mean, just the platform that he has, he just knows so many doctors throughout the world, and they happen to approach us with some of their problems and what they want to accomplish. And so, yes, there's a great percentage of practicing doctors and surgeons among our clientele, but that doesn't mean we're actively only seeking them, right? It's literally any client, whether it's an individual, sometimes they're in academia and they're scientists, right? Or they're a small startup company who tried to do it on their own and they've hit some walls and it's hard to proceed. And so they need some help. And so they come to us. Or, believe it or not, we have multinational corporations who are looking for a smaller partner to work with them in a given area, right? And so a lot of the large companies like Medtronic, J&J, you name it, in the past, they used to have a massive R&D team in-house, right? Like just a ton of individuals whose job are just to invent new things and develop new products from within that company. Now, the model has shifted, and those same companies, Medtronic, J&J, and so forth, are looking more toward smaller companies to de-risk these ideas for them, basically, get a little market traction, then they come in and acquire the whole thing and just bring that entire unit under its wing. And so whether it's companies like Medtronic purchasing robotics companies, right? Instead of developing a surgical robot entirely in-house, they let companies like Mazor or similar companies develop it outside of Medtronic. And once that technology develops to a certain threshold and they get enough market traction, that's when they become attractive for acquisition. And so that's sort of become more the model these days.
Yeah. Let's say you're an urgent care doctor in Seattle and you have a new idea of maintaining patient records. Think of the top of my head. I mean, how do you evaluate it? Is that something that's valuable, or is it, but let's put aside, you do a prior art search and there's nothing else out there, but how do you kind of evaluate if it's something valuable to even try to commercialize to go down that road? I guess, you know, what kind of gut check can you do?
Oh, right. So it is a multi-step process. Assuming you did perform the legal due diligence, right? And so you did the search, it appears no one else has protected that idea. Well, then before we proceed, we need to make sure, is this new invention or idea valuable or worth it? Is there a need for it in the life science marketplace, right? And so we have clinicians like Dr. Rowe and other people in our network, especially in those types of technology areas, that can vet the idea. And so that's part of our business model is, listen, if somebody comes to us with an idea, that's an initial service we provide. We help actually vet it. And whether there's a need for it in the marketplace, whether somebody has already saturated that field. And so even if the IP is clear to pursue, it may not be worth even doing because there's an alternative solution that already has an insurance reimbursement code and everyone's super happy with it. And this new idea that a small company is trying to develop is only marginally better. And there really is no reason for entire hospital systems, for example, to jump ship and adopt this new one because it's close enough. So there is a real world gut check, as you put it, that needs to be had, because it's easy to try to think of an incremental improvement over an existing technology, but it's an entirely different thing to prove that the market needs that, or it's attractive enough for people to abandon what they're doing currently.
Let's use a simple example. They use a surgical tool, and maybe you come up with a new surgical tool, and if it's a better surgical tool, then I guess it's a no-brainer to use that. Let's say there's something completely new that doctors would have to adopt, right? For example, a new process that they'd have to do before surgery or something like that. Is one of them more valuable than the other?
You're weighing two choices. One is an incremental improvement in an existing technology, which still may be very valuable, right? Because it is an improvement. And then on the other hand, you're asking, well, what if there's just this new, completely different approach that no one has even thought of yet, and what we classify as a heavy lift, right? Like, it's so new and it would require so many resources to develop and get FDA clearance and get adoption in various hospital systems. Like, the lift would be just immense and massive. Is that worth pursuing? And the answer is yes. Like, both choices are attractive. Obviously, the first choice, where it's a valuable yet incremental improvement over an existing technology, that's extremely attractive still. Because if it's a big enough improvement and it really does improve patient outcomes enough, then doctors are hungry for that. And to get FDA clearance is much easier because it's an improvement on a previously submitted technology, right? And you don't have to teach physicians entirely, you know, new ways of solving a problem, because it's just a slightly better way of doing it. And so if it can get to the marketplace faster and get adopted faster, that's clearly attractive, right? If, on the other hand, you have this entirely new platform that no one's even thought of yet, clearly that return will take much longer because this is a long-term, heavy lift project, but it's still attractive. So if you have an entirely new platform to cure, for example, amyloid diseases like Alzheimer's, right? So one of our portfolio companies, AltPep, is in that exact position. They have a novel way of diagnosing and even treating diseases like Alzheimer's. Is that going to happen overnight? No. They have the IP protected. They're developing it. They're at the University of Washington, you know. But it's going to take some time. It may mean a larger company will come in and take it over and really pump in tons of resources. But at the same time, like, they're doing great. They raised millions of dollars and they're on their way to revolutionizing diagnosis and treatment of amyloid diseases. So it's, but that's a heavy lift. That doesn't make it any less attractive, but just you need to know that the time horizon is going to be a little bit longer.
Do you see any qualities, I guess, in doctors that kind of are able to come up with valuable ideas?
The doctors that we see more often than not are the ones that are not only just leading experts in their field. I mean, I'm talking world class. They're published. Other doctors go to these doctors to learn how to do cutting edge procedures. So one, they're like that. And then two, more often than not, they have a business savvy about them, whether it's an actual MBA degree or it's business experience where they've developed technology and they've helped companies bring it to market.
Yeah. When they come to IntuitiveX, do you need any of your own funding or can a doctor kind of come to you guys with just an idea and go from there?
Yeah. So it really is a large spectrum of what they ask for. And so sometimes it really is a client coming to us for a specific service and they think we can provide it not only better than anyone else, but at a price point that's attractive. And that's all they want. They don't want to give up equity. They don't need massive fundraising. They're just like, listen, I'm a doctor. I know everything there is about this particular procedure. I want to protect it and bring it to market. But what I lack is regulatory expertise. I can invent all day long. I have no idea how to get it through the FDA. Can you help me? And if that's literally all they want, we can do that. And we can do it in record time. But if it's more than that, though, where beyond being a pure service client, they want a long-term partner, right? Whether it's they want to be incubated or they just want us to sometimes even build that startup with them, which includes raising money and so forth for equity, et cetera, then we're willing to do it, especially if we believe in that individual or individuals and that product. So a lot of times, you know, we get clients who say, hey, just right from, you know, day one, they're like, we want to be incubated. We have no money. Please raise money for us. Just take over, incubate us. And we're like, no, thank you, because it's just not a good fit, right? So whether the technology just isn't in the right area or we just don't believe in the viability of the product, whatever it is, there more often than not, we politely decline, but we'd be happy to provide the service that they need for a fee. But sometimes we learn enough about each other, and it really does go both ways, where they believe in IX enough and we believe in them that, hey, let's go in this long term. So not only will we provide these services, but we'll help you raise money. You don't have to pay for everything. We'll take an equity position in your company and truly have skin in the game. We'll help you to the end. It really is a spectrum. Sometimes we want to acquire a position in the company and provide more than just a handful of services, but maybe the client doesn't want that, right? So maybe it's a sort of a pushback in the other way.
Do you operate in some ways like a traditional seed investor? Obviously, there's VC incubators in that you sift through a lot of ideas and then that 1% kind of makes it into your incubator.
We're not, for example, a venture capital firm, right? And so we're not just sitting on a ton of money looking for targets to throw money at, right? I mean, yes, there's going to be extreme diligence involved and VCs, you know, imagine massive returns on each of their investments, but we're not a VC and we're not private equity either. We work with those types of entities, but that's not what IX is. We really do want to help innovators and companies, small and large, really bring the best products to market. And along the way, sure, we will help them raise money. We may take an equity position. And more often than not, if both sides believe in what the other side is doing, then it does end up in a pretty fruitful partnership where we really do develop and protect their ideas, test and validate it, build prototypes, FDA approval, manufacturing, distribution channels, all the way. And that's a rewarding process to identify a new idea or invention or product that has that type of potential and getting it all the way there. So Amplify Surgical started out as just an idea of how to improve orthopedic spine surgery, whether it's through portals, minimally invasive, or it's a new expandable implant. It's both the approach and the device. But if you want to focus on the device, it's when you get a spinal fusion, you have to put a cage between two vertebrae to fuse them together. In the past, it used to be just a solid, a piece that doesn't expand. And then it turned into an expandable piece where it collapses small, goes in small, and then once it's between the vertebrae, you can expand it up. But now Amplify Surgical has the first dual expansion spinal implant cage, right? So this implant, once it goes in extremely small, expands laterally, and then it expands vertically. So it has a large footprint after it's expanded, and then it creates a large space in between the vertebrae. So that's completely novel. And it collapses because it's in two directions. It goes in extremely small. The healing and the recovery time is expedited greatly. And so we went out and licensed this technology. We had to raise a seed round to get enough money to go ahead and license the technology. Then we used that seed money to build a prototype, test and validate it, get FDA approval in a few months.
They came to you with the idea and they got you interested, right, because of everything that you described. And at that point, you're like, all right, we'll do everything that we need to do, I guess, to make you guys successful.
Yes, including going out and getting their CEO. So we even get their executive team together. These four surgeons in Korea were actually the ones who approached us first, but they have day jobs. They're accomplished surgeons, and they just wanted somebody to help them bring that type of idea to market where they don't have to retire from their day job. And so that's why we're like, okay, clearly you need a CEO and a full-time team to get this to market and to even develop it. We'll go find them and put that team together. We'll help you raise money, develop the technology, get it through the FDA, and bring it to market. And then for the past couple of years, have over 1,000 successful surgeries. And so they're at a point where not only are they profitable, so they can be an ongoing entity, or like we mentioned earlier in this interview, they're large companies who are looking for the best possible implant that's different from anyone else's may want to come in and acquire. And here's the really interesting point is, because we have so many industry experts, right, including physicians who can test and validate the idea, right? And so that's sort of a vetting process. But for those ideas that successfully pass that vetting process, these doctors already know about the idea and they've already given a green light and a thumbs up. So when it comes time, for example, to get investors, they're the first investors. They want to invest because they're like, we've already vetted this idea with IX. We want to invest in it because this is a winner. And then after it gets FDA approval and the company starts to manufacture these devices and need to get into hospital systems, who are the doctors who use it? The ones who already vetted it and the ones who already invested in it. So they're the biggest cheerleaders for the product. And it's a very intriguing business model where you utilize industry experts to not only vet what the winners are, but then leverage them for the fundraising process and also for your distribution channel. It really develops organically.
That is very interesting because you hear of these VCs where you can invest alongside them. And obviously everybody who does that is kind of a cheerleader for that company, but it seems like you guys did that in a much more focused space where it works much better because everybody who's investing has expertise indirectly in that area.
It is. And you're touching upon another interesting point where in sort of the high-tech space, the market can get a little bit saturated with all these VCs and private equity firms who are trying to invest in the newest, you know, software app or whatever it is, right? And there's a little bit less of that activity in the life science and clinical space. And so that's where we believe IntuitiveX really fills that need. There really aren't that many companies that do what IntuitiveX does.
You have like groups of doctors, you know, in different specialties. You have somebody come up with an idea, you know, this is a group of doctors that you can go to for innovations related to this specialty. A different idea, you go to this group of doctors. Do you guys have anything like that?
Sure, in the sense that various surgeons in different specialty groups have their own organizations, right? And so, you know, orthopedic surgeons have spine surgery, you know, conferences every year, and there's different groups. Like, for example, they can get really specific, like CAS. If you're a Korean spine surgeon, they have a conference and organization for that. There are a lot of different industry groups and practice groups that gather and share information, ideas all the time. And so if we did have a client, or internally, if we had a brand new idea and wanted feedback, yes, absolutely. You can totally leverage all these various groups to see what their feedback is and how the marketplace would respond.
Young associate or young law students listening to this, and they think it's super exciting and they want to become the next Mark Hahn to get involved in something, you know, that's a little bit off the beaten path. What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, if you have a passion, for example, that's something beyond billable hours, right? So you're a young associate at a firm, and that can be a rewarding career in and of itself. You know, I don't want to take anything away from law firm attorneys. You know, we work with outside counsel like all the time, and some of them are hilarious and they love what they're doing and they're geniuses in their own field. But if a young associate came to me and said, hey, I like patent law and I feel fortunate to have a job at a great firm, but I'm looking for something different, then, you know, going in-house is always an option. And a lot of law firm attorneys, whether they admit it or not, they look for openings like in-house positions at really leading companies because it can be fun and the hours sometimes are less demanding. But if you want to be part of like something exciting in the sense that, hey, I want to be part of a small group, possibly a startup company, and try to be whatever, next Facebook or whatever it is, where, you know, even if I'm an attorney, I want to be part of that team and bring something new and exciting to the market, then I say go for it. But just know what you're getting into. It's not easy. It's more often than not, startups just honestly fail. You may have a great idea and really motivated and energetic team, but just if the timing isn't there, then a lot of times it just doesn't happen. And yes, luck is a big part of that, but timing's important. Grit is absolutely important. You greatly increase the odds of success if you have a team that refuses to give up and you know what the marketplace is asking for, and the timing is reasonable, then you have a good chance of succeeding. And so I would encourage people to make that step, because there's a lot of good ideas that unfortunately don't make it to the marketplace because there's just not enough people who are willing to step up and take on that challenge. But if you are, I'm telling you, the world needs you. The marketplace needs you to bring that fire and energy into bringing that great idea to the marketplace, and especially in the life science space where patients and just everyday people can greatly benefit and live healthier lives, then by all means, please do it.
Thanks, Mark. That's great advice, and thanks again for joining.
Great. Thank you, Eli. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Or if you'd like to learn more about my firm, visit heritylp.com.